Good morning. On behalf of my co-authors, Muzabel Longo and Meriwether Beatty, I'm going to talk about adolescent reproductive health needs in Kakuma Refugee Camp. This presentation is based on a project that all of us worked on between 2012 and 2014. I have no relationships to disclose. This program and research that I'll be talking about were funded by a grant to JSI's Research and Training Institute's Reproductive Health for Refugees program, that grant from the Packard Foundation. And some of my time and my trip here to this conference were funded by an NIH Training Center grant. So first I'm going to tell you a little bit about Kakuma Refugee Camp, and then I'll tell you what we did, how we did it, some of our key findings, and then the conclusions that we hope you'll remember. Kakuma Refugee Camp is located in northwest Kenya, just there. It's one of two camps in Kenya, the other being the much larger Dadaab, which is near the Somali border. It opened in 1992 to house the Sudanese lost boys and others displaced by fighting in Sudan. And by 2004, the camp had refugees from 8 countries. When South Sudan became independent, a lot of those refugees returned to South Sudan, but then refugees from Somalia and the DRC started arriving in larger numbers. By 2013, when our project began, the camp population was 100,000, which at the time was considered maximum capacity. By the time we did our N-line survey in June 2014, the population had increased by another 50,000. So Kiswahili and English are the main languages used. Because Kakuma has been around for so long, it's maybe a little bit different from other humanitarian settings. Many people have lived there for their entire lives. Certainly many adolescents have. These photos show some of the institutions and services that refugees have set up. This is not to say that it's comfortable, but just to give you a sense of how long-term this situation is. So there's commerce, but if you're an adolescent and you want to get pills or an injectable without your family and neighbors finding out, you're out of luck. Family planning services are provided in clinics in a room with a label like this. Unmarried teenagers with no children are not going to go in a room labeled postnatal care and family planning. There's community-based distribution of condoms that's targeted at high-risk adults, and there's an after-school program called Healthy Choices for young adolescents that mostly promotes staying in school and abstinence. One of the guiding principles of JSI's Astarte project is to foster leadership within communities and build their capacity to help themselves. In this context, JSI partnered with a Kenyan NGO, NCCK, and 3 community-based refugee-led organizations, Support, Solidarity, and Advocacy for the Vulnerable in Crisis, Hope for the Vulnerable, and Aliform. All 3 were already providing adolescent and adult literacy and numeracy, as well as vocational skills training. The format of the program was that each organization hired health promoters from within their communities. The community-based promoters then started reproductive health clubs in schools or other settings. And they met weekly, each club met weekly for 4 months. The program's main aims were to increase knowledge and communication about family planning among youth and their families, and to increase the use of family planning to reduce adolescent pregnancy. And HIV prevention was a secondary aim. We'd hoped to get funding to continue beyond the first year, but we didn't. By the end of the first year, then, we hadn't succeeded in making youth-friendly services available or including activities for boys and parents, as had been planned at the beginning. So we were kind of ambitious with our study design. We thought that participants would share information and influence their peers, so we decided to have population-based survey samples before and after. The post-sample would include participants and non-participants because we thought they might have all been influenced by the intervention. While the program was being implemented, 2 other things were happening in the background. The first was that the Kenyan government required all refugees to be in camps, and so they started rounding up refugees in Nairobi and other cities and bringing them to the camps. The other was there was the outbreak of fighting in South Sudan that's still ongoing now. Most of the Sudanese new arrivals settled in a new part of the camp, which was not in our project nor our evaluation, and the urban refugees often had connections or were actually registered in Kakuma, and so they moved throughout the camp, and so they might be included in our study. So for the baseline, we first sampled camp blocks, which there were 96 at the time, and then from each selected block, we sampled 10 girls. The day before interviewing, mobilizers would go to a block and recruit participants. They told girls who were willing to participate to come to a central location the following day to be interviewed. We thought this would increase privacy for the girls and also make things easier for us, but because by having all of our interviewers in one place, there was a greater likelihood that there would be we could interview a girl in her native language. But some part of this process didn't work because usually the 10 girls, some girls showed up, but not all 10. So then we started sending our interviewers to the blocks to interview. By the time we planned the end line survey, having seen the program, we didn't expect it to have the impact at the community level that we'd originally hoped. So we thought it would be important to also try and demonstrate the great need that remained in the camp. And so we decided to include all of the blocks in our sample, partly because we wanted to demonstrate the need and partly because the program was afraid that if we chose a subsample, that we might end up choosing blocks by chance that they hadn't worked in. And to make sure we had enough girls who had been program participants to get feedback about the program, we had a supplementary sample of girls from the program list. We based our questionnaires on toolkits from UNFPA, Save the Children, CDC, and Focus on Young Adults. We had written questionnaires in English and Swahili, and then interviewers translated it into their local language. Between them, the interviewer team spoke Somali, Arabic, Dinka, Nuer, French, Kenya, Rwanda, Amharic, and all of them spoke English and Swahili. In the baseline, our sample was 322. I'll be presenting the end line in two groups, those who were sampled at the block level and did not participate in the program, and those who participated, whether we sampled them at the block or as part of the extra sample. The program group also includes a few girls who did healthy choices because our program participation question wasn't specific enough, so we can't distinguish which program it was. So our respondents were girls aged 14 to 18. In accordance with UNFPA and other recommendations, we got consent from girls only and not their parents. Both the mobilizers and the interviewers asked for a verbal consent. We did ask for general permission from community leaders to work in the area. Our interviewers were female refugees in their late teens or 20s who were not involved in the program. And our mobilizers were mostly people who had been involved in the program, and some of them were men. The interviewers were all women. So I'm going to present the results in kind of a good news followed by bad news format, showing first findings that are promising and then some that are a little bit disappointing. A theme throughout is that program participants often look a little better than non-participants, but they're all a long way from where we want them to be. I won't be showing any slides on background characteristics, but I can tell you that the three groups were very similar in age and nationality, but program participants were a bit more likely to be currently in school and to live in father-headed households. For most results, I'll be comparing the orange program group at end line to the light blue baseline group and the dark blue end line non-programmer comparison group. So the orange and dark blue are at the end line, light blue is at the, you can't really see it, I guess it's whitish. That was the baseline. And I want to emphasize that I'm not assuming that the difference between the blue and the orange can be attributed to our program. The participants were self-selected, and so we're pretty sure they were different on many non-observable characteristics. And our results are cross-sectional, so we can't tell if the individual girls changed as a result of their participation. In this slide, we can see that program participants talked about sex, pregnancy, and family planning more often with peers and with parents than did the other two groups, which was one of the goals of the project. But still, the proportions are lower than we had expected. In this graph, all of the responses except the very last column are unprompted. So we asked if they knew, we asked them to list the family planning methods they knew. Girls who participated in the program knew a lot more family planning methods than other girls. The comparison group also knew a lot more than they did at baseline. We were a bit shocked that there were any girls who had participated in the program and didn't recognize at least one method when they were prompted, but we're hoping that these were the healthy choices girls. So program girls knew more methods, and in this slide we can see they're slightly more likely to believe that condoms are effective at preventing pregnancy and HIV, but we see that they're also more likely to believe in myths. So more than half of program girls and almost half of the baseline and comparison girls agreed with statements saying, I would not use family planning because of side effects. The pill and injectables are more dangerous for young people than pregnancy, and the pill causes infertility. Fewer, but still more than 30% of all three groups agreed with the statement that condoms are dangerous for youth. We asked girls where they or a friend would go if they needed contraception. Only 10% of the program girls said they didn't know, compared to more than 30% of the other groups. Camp clinics were almost the only source mentioned. This finding is a little troubling because here we see that only half of program girls and even few of other girls thought that anyone could use family planning services at the clinic. About 30% of girls at the end line thought that women had to be married, and a few thought that they already had to have at least one child. And if you remember the earlier photo that I showed where family planning and postnatal care are offered in the same room, this makes sense. This slide shows one of the limitations of our survey. Less than half of girls said they'd ever had a boyfriend or a male partner. Less than 30% said they'd ever had sex, but 60 to 70% thought most girls their age were sexually active. When asked if they were confident if they could refuse, if they were offered gifts or money in exchange for sex, less than 20% thought they themselves couldn't refuse, but they weren't so confident in their peers. More than half thought that most other girls would exchange sex for gifts or money. We think that this suggests that our self-reports of sexual experience are underestimates, and perhaps self-efficacy is an overestimate. Since we had such low reports of sexual activity at baseline, we decided to ask a hypothetical question about contraception in the end-line survey. Here we see that half of the comparison girls and 40% of the program girls said no, that they did not expect to use family planning during adolescence. More than half of those who said no said it was because they didn't need it, but more than a fourth said it was because they or someone else, like their partner or their religion, was opposed to family planning. And program girls were also much more likely to cite method characteristics such as side effects or inconvenience as a reason, and they were equally likely to cite myths such as family planning causing infertility. So because the title of this session is International Research, I thought I'd include some big picture considerations for international research, especially in humanitarian settings. The first issue is to be certain that a survey is really the right method. In our case, the survey was part of our work plan, but on reflection, it mostly just confirmed what we knew from focus groups, and I wonder if the effort and expense might have been better spent in another way. And people are pretty tired of being interviewed and feel they don't get much in return. Something we found particularly true in this setting was that we had to be physically present for our NGO partner to focus on the research. We found our CBO partners to be more effective, possibly because what's a small program for an NGO is a bigger deal for a CBO, but they didn't necessarily have the resources or influence they needed. So how do you choose the right number of languages and allocate resources? For practical reasons, we only translated the questionnaire into Swahili, but ideally we would have had more translations. We also had a lot of debates about whether girls would be most comfortable and speak openly with someone who was from the same background or an outsider who might be less judgmental, and I would love to hear other people's ideas about that. So some advice I have for all researchers. One is you need more time. Everything takes longer than you expected, especially since no one bothered to mention World Refugee Day when you were planning your fieldwork. You have too many questions. Interviewers get tired and respondents get tired. This was the first survey that most of our field staff had worked on, and they were very capable, but if I were to do it again, I would build in more time to train supervisors to support them in the field and start up more slowly to give everyone more practice. And now some conclusions about meeting adolescent reproductive health needs in humanitarian settings. Teaching girls to be abstinent or negotiate condom use is ineffective and unfair if you don't also teach boys. Reproductive health is not just a woman's issue. We need to strive for the perfect balance between meeting immediate needs in an emergency and ensuring long-term sustainable development. Even in a protracted camp setting, refugees, especially young refugees, don't have access to comprehensive reproductive health services. The repeated crises will always be a challenge, making it essential to strengthen the capacity of CBOs and local and national NGOs. For example, although JSI's funding ended over a year ago, one of our CBOs, Savik, is continuing to work on adolescent sexual and reproductive health, which you can see here from their recent newsletter. And finally, as our research results demonstrate, programs here and in other refugee camps need to be comprehensive and provide services, emphasizing the range of family planning options and their safety. Otherwise, all you have is an abstinence-only program. Thank you.